and welcome to another episode of Sacred Cinema with me, your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, on the 2XX FM 98.3 frequency. This week, we're taking a look at cinematic depictions of the Deep Blue Sea. Oh no, I'm drowning. Yes, you and I, we're taking a trip through the Big Blue. That is La Oceana, yes. The Deep Blue Sea. Interpret that as you will. Maybe it's an ocean. Maybe it's just a big wide river that you know of. We're talking about the abyss, being underwater, being without oxygen, I guess you could say. And why are we talking about that this week? Well, last week we were talking about World War II films. We were trying to figure out what we can learn about ourselves through World War II and looking at World War II through films about World War II. And part of that involved looking at the film Das Boot. And we got into this conversation about how that film, being in a submarine in the middle of the ocean, it's kind of the perfect metaphor for being in amongst a war in a way, or the reason or the justification for engaging in warfare. You know, there's this sense of isolation, but there's a fear, an inherent fear of what lurks past the abyss, past that great wall of the unknown. You're suffocated within this encasing force field, and it induces a lot of fear, and in turn the consequence of that is a lot of aggression and violence. So I thought we could take a bit more of a deeper dive into that. Has the concept of the ocean or the deep blue sea, has that been conveyed throughout cinematic history in a certain way? What are some of the insights? What are some of the lessons about the human experience, the human spirit, that we can learn from cinematic symbols of the Deep Blue Sea? And this week we're going to kind of go in this sort of linear direction, or we're going to start in a fairly literal zone and then sort of move into something a little bit more conceptual, or something that's a little bit more realistic, but still uses these ideas about the abyss, about quiet, silence, the suffocating nature of the encompassing ocean when we're within it. But before we do that, we should probably go back to some of the historical uses of the ocean and the sea and its depictions of the human spirit. I suppose it starts in ancient Greece, doesn't it, with Poseidon, and later on, obviously, Neptune is the Roman version of the god of the sea. Probably pretty important to note from the outset that Poseidon was very often considered one of the more bad-tempered gods. He was quite a moody guy, quite aggressive in a way, and actually very greedy, I've read as well. And what I think is also interesting, I didn't know this until very recently, but Poseidon wasn't just the god of the sea. He was also the god of earthquakes specifically, and the god of horses. But if you think about the sort of the clamoring on the ground, the sort of thundering gallop of a horse along a hard dirt path, and the sound of an earthquake and crashing waves, there is a very aggressive sort of energy to Poseidon, this sort of crashing, destructive god who sort of is kind of unrelenting or a little bit unpredictable as well. When we think about earthquakes and tidal waves and galloping horses, there is this sort of, not necessarily that, I don't mean to say that they're on a continuum, but they reoccur. At least the gallop of a horse has a steady rhythm to it. Waves also have that kind of continuous series that they follow. And then an earthquake is sort of spontaneous, but it's nevertheless inevitable. And they don't sort of go away. It's weather events in general are sort of saying that we can sort of consider inevitable, that there's sort of maybe a gap in between them, but we kind of fear them coming again and sort of batten down the hatches to ensure that we're not as hurt as we were last time, the next time they come about. I also think, before we carry on as well, I wouldn't mind mentioning the biblical story of Jonah and the whale. Because I think it's in the Old Testament, but I've got to be careful about how we talk about the Testaments and what's biblical and that sort of thing. But we all know what I'm talking about. Jonah is not only in a whale and swallowed by a whale, but the whale itself is swallowed within the ocean itself. So I think when we're talking about the ocean, when we're talking about the sea, this is the idea of being all-encompassed, being encased by something. There's this sort of a double force field sort of thing going on. Not only are you immobilized, but you can't breathe. Not only that, but you can't see. You can't really hear very well. You can't call out to anyone. You can only taste salt water. It's sort of this vacuum, very similar to space, as sort of a terrestrial space in a way. But let's move on now to the films. Let's see what film history has to say about the ocean and the commentary that it can provide about the human experience. Well, as I mentioned before, we're going to start in a fairly sort of literal depiction of the ocean. We're going to start with a film from 1999 directed by Ronnie Harlan. And that would be Deep Blue Sea, the shark movie. Then we're going to move on to another movie about the ocean. That would be The Big Blue, directed by Luc Besson. That one came out in 1988. And then we're going to go into a fairly sort of literal application of some of the lessons or insights that we've lifted up this week. And we're going to finish off with Terence Davies' film from 2011, and that would be The Deep Blue Sea. But let's get started now with the 1999 film. Deep Blue Sea. So if you haven't seen this one, the plot basically centers on a group of scientists, or mostly scientists, who are researching Alzheimer's disease. And they have created these super smart sharks in this offshore laboratory. And because they're playing God in a way, things get out of hand, the sharks escape, and they've sort of got to run for their lives. If you think about it, it's a kind of a mix between the Poseidon Adventure, you know, when that ship goes down, that Titanic-esque kind of movie. There's actually been a couple of them, and they have to sort of resurface to get back to Earth or get back to land. A mix between sort of Poseidon and Jaws in a way. If what would happen if Jaws, the shark from Jaws, was swimming around the boat in the Poseidon Adventure? Now, obviously, if we're talking shark films, we're talking ocean films, you might be saying, listen, Jimmy, why aren't you talking about Jaws itself? Part of the reason for that is because I kind of wanted all this alliteration in the title of this week's show. I like the idea of doing Deep Blue Sea, The Big Blue, and The Deep Blue Sea, all having them adjacent to each other. But I kind of really like this movie, and I know this movie resonated with me a lot as a kid. It was always on. I'm pretty sure it was on Channel 9. This movie was always on. It was one of the movies it was a bit like Godzilla. I always wanted to watch it. I always liked like monster movies, and I remember the first time I got to watch it from start to end when I was old enough to stay up that late. I was so excited to watch this one. And just speaking from personal experience, I've had a lot of recurring dreams in my life that I think originate from some of the imagery in this film. Specifically, there is a shot, or there's multiple shots, I should say, at the beginning of the film before everything goes badly, where the characters are walking around this research facility. And obviously, because it's based in the middle of the ocean, it's kind of dark and there's lots of little electronic kind of neon lights everywhere. But for the most part, it's very dark. And you can kind of see the shadows and the murmurings and the silhouettes of the sharks kind of swimming past the windows. And I used to find that very eerie. And I actually had a dream, a recurring dream, and I've had it for much of my life, where I'm in this dark office, this dark facility. I'm the only one there, and I can see this sort of like a red exit sign or some kind of red neon sign, and there's a big rectangular glass screen, and I know that there's a massive shark on the other side of that screen in this very dark, deep tank. And I don't know whether to walk over to it because maybe it'll swim out of nowhere and pop up in front of the mirror, in front of the window. But I know it's there, and I know that I'm in this dark facility. I don't know if I'm the only one here, but I'm the only one that I'm in that room at the time. And I also had this very strange dream as well, where I'm walking around some kind of abandoned or derelict rundown, I guess it's like a water park, and sort of the barnacles have got to it and the seaweeds got to it. You can see it was once a structured formal facility, but now it's kind of a little bit, you're worried you might get cut on an oyster if you swim in the water. And this film has that kind of shot in it near the end of the film, when the whole facility is kind of broken down, and you can sort of see the vestiges or what used to be in terms of the tanks and the pens, but it's sort of all broken down on fire. And I don't mean to say that this film is one of the great films of cinematic history, but I definitely think a lot of the images in this film do resonate with people, or at least people who are into things like sharks and nature and the ocean and that sort of thing. So I always loved watching this movie as a kid, and I did feel like talking about it this week. But I want to talk about this one rather than talk about Jaws. I want to talk about this one because I think it builds on some of the rules or the lessons or laws that Jaws enacted when it first came out. People know Jaws to be famous because it's representative or conveys how you don't show the monster in a monster movie, right? Until you really need to. Like, in that famous first scene, that first attack scene in Jaws, we don't actually see a fin or anything. Even though we're very horrified and scared, we're scared of something we can't even see. It's not actually there. There was never really a shark there. This is all movie magic, right? And then it's not until near the end of the film that we actually see Jaws. Is that the shark's name, by the way? Is it called Jaws? Anyway, I'm just going to call him Jaws. Until we see Jaws at the end of the film. And so the lesson that we draw from that is, you know, you don't show your monsters to let the viewer's imagination torture them. Make people build it up in their mind so that it's this big, scary thing. Because once you show it, you kind of know its limits. You're familiarized with it, and then you're no longer going to be scared. Well, this film sort of breaks that rule. Or does it, right? So at the beginning of this film, we get the classic first scene where, you know, there's a shark attack sort of thing. But the shark doesn't actually eat the people that it attacks, gets harpooned by this salt of the earth guy named Carter. We'll talk a bit more about him in just a second. And he brings it back to the facility. And then when he gets back to the facility and he's showing Samuel Jackson, who owns the whole thing, around the place, he actually dives in to the pen and the sharks chase him. And he like swims up to it. And actually, we're going to talk about a film in just a second. There's a similar scene in, he kind of grabs it by the nose and swims alongside it and like gets this number plate out of its teeth. And sort of like, he's like, oh, there you go, big fella. And then he gets back out of the water and he talks to Samuel Jackson. He's like, see, I just had to get this number plate out of his teeth. They don't really like us. They don't really want to eat us. Don't worry about it. And so we're immediately at the beginning of this film. You almost think that this is a massive blunder. We're already familiarized with these sharks. And we're not really scared of them at all, right? So when you watch this film, are you not scared at all? Is the remainder of this film just a big bore? Well, no, not at all. Because what happens from there is it... Well, at least from my perspective, or for the sake of this show, we then have to start asking our question, hang on, what are these characters actually fearing? Yes, I know that the sharks are super, super big and super smart and that sort of thing, but what are they actually fearing? And this takes us back to that conversation we've been having for the last couple of weeks about man versus nature and combating nature, and can that actually be done? And what are some of the ramifications of trying to do that? And so this is the classic sort of, I would go as far as to say, almost stereotypical characterization where the scientific, the doctor type actor, character, she's sort of this egghead scientist. And it's like, you know what? You don't really, you know, you think you're so smart, but you don't really understand these creatures. And then you've got Carter, this character, who's that sort of salt of the earth wrangler type. He's not an intellectual. He's not a scientist, but he does know how to get himself salty. And it's a bit like in Jaws, where they got the pirate guy that he really knows what's up because he knows sharks. But it's interesting. I was thinking about this when I was watching the film. I was like, why does that resonate? Why does the director have trust in us as the audience to know that Carter is the one to listen to and not this egghead scientist who's clearly smarter, or capital S smarter than he is? And it's almost like we have something in our collective unconscious, isn't it? We kind of know the people that think that they can overcome nature, the ones that think they can combat it. You know, this is going back to a couple of weeks when we talked about the Mosquito Coast. Those people seem very dangerous and precarious. We know that it's not going to work out for them. It's similar to that movie Armageddon, the Michael Bay film, when you've got Bruce Willis's character. It's like, look, I understand that you egghead scientists think you can understand how an oil drill works, but I got the best guys. You know, they didn't go to fancy guys. It's like this concept of knowing that, you know, respecting hard work or expecting elbow, respecting elbow grease, people that can really put their back into something, people who are, you know, men of the land, that sort of thing. We seem to have this sort of unconscious bias and unconscious trust in those kinds of people. So if we're going to build on that, it's sort of like that. It's the people that accept that nature is unpredictable and cruel, or understand it's how profound it is or how mysterious it is. And it's ignoring that guarantees the horror and the fear, right? It's the characters that don't take nature seriously or don't embrace the mystery of nature or the inevitable strength of nature. We're going back to what we're talking about Poseidon. The people that don't respect how dangerous an earthquake can be, or the thundering galloping of a horse can be, those are ones that get kicked off and break their neck, right? Those are the ones ones that are then put in those very, very dangerous situations. So I guess in another way, it's actually the murkiness of the water that induces the fear, and not so much the thing that lurks within it. It's the thing that we don't understand. It's the fact that we don't understand that induces the fear, rather than the thing that appears and then shows itself. So in alignment with Jaws, even though that breaks the rule, it's still very much in alignment with Jaws. It's not that it so shows the shark. It's that it maintains this sense of mystery. And so in Deep Blue Sea, we're not actually scared of the sharks themselves. What we're scared of is the water. And it's a bit like watching that movie Contagion, where you know that Steven Soderbergh movie, where you're kind of scared for them to touch anything. You know, you're not so much scared of the virus at that point. You're scared of them to touch something because you know that the virus is sort of potentially there. But the way that we conceive of fear or conceive of the enemy changes. And it's the same in this movie. It's not that there's a shark there and you're saying to them, oh, you know, stay away from the shark. It's when they have to get into the water. You know, they keep having these arguments about, oh, we've got to swim to the top. And they go, I don't want to get back in the water. I don't want to swim in the water. It is the water itself that they fear for what... because things exist within it that they cannot see, that they cannot, that they can't manage, or they can't pre-manage, they can't apprehend at that point, they can't conceive of them in that moment. So, I suppose, in understanding water and the ocean itself to be the enemy, the all-encompassing body of water, 70% of the earth itself being the enemy, are there any films that show characters taking that on in an act of heroism? Well, obviously, Deep Blue Sea has a bit of that. But there's another film that maybe takes it to another level. Before we do that, I just want to remind you are listening to 2XX on the 98.3 FM frequency. You're listening to me, Jimmy Bernasconi, presenting Sacred Cinema. If you like what you're hearing, please stick around if you're listening live for much, much more content on 2XX, or tune in to 2XX on the on-demand platform on our website. While you're there, feel free to subscribe to the station or sponsor the show. All that would be very much appreciated. Moving on now, though, to our second film for today. I'm going to talk about Luc Besson's 1988 film, The Big Blue. Now, if you haven't seen this one, it's about free diving. And this one reminded me a lot of that movie Free Solo, you know, with the rock climbing guy. So free diving, if you don't know what it is, it's when people dive under the water without the tank. And so it's about these two divers. One is Jacques, one is Enzo. People would recognize Enzo. He always plays a French character in every film he's ever in. But his actual name is Jean Reno. And then Jacques is played by Jean-Marc Barr. This one's also got Rosanna Arquette in it, and she plays Joanna. But I'm going to focus specifically today on Jacques and Enzo's relationship, or at least what they're doing. And they're these sort of two divers that are egging each other on. They're friends, or they've known each other since they were kids, and they've had this rivalry, and they're challenging each other to go deeper and deeper for this world record. I think it's like the 14th annual freediving record. And Enzo, Jean Reno's character, he's kind of got the belt. He's the man for the job, but then he encourages Jacques to get involved as well. And now, what's crucial to this film, and it's made very clear at the beginning of this film, because the first sequence is all in black and white, and it's when they're kids, and it's really important, it sort of acts as the backdrop for the entire film. Jacques' dad passed away while he was diving. He has this old school wooden swimsuit thing, and he goes off into the abyss of the ocean, and he suffocates and he dies. And they're actually both Enzo and Jacques as boys. They were both there to experience what happened that day. So in the backdrop, it's almost like Jacques is seeking to avenge his father by dominating, or by taming, or by confronting the ocean itself. He sees that it's something that can be overcome, or something that can be challenged. It was something that killed his father, and he's going to avenge his father by diving even deeper, going even deeper into the darkness of the depths of the ocean. And because Enzo's character, he's sort of like the older guy, he was sort of his mentor, he's kind of this big brother, fatherly kind of relationship with him, I think he sort of sees a bit of his father in Enzo. And there's actually a shot in the film when, you know, later in the, when they're doing the competition, everything, where there's a sort of a flash of that scene where Jacques saw his father drown. So he's sort of assimilating, and everyone that's sort of encompassed or encased or swallowed by the ocean, sort of Jacques sort of puts him in this basket of victims that have been taken by the ocean, and it's sort of up to him to defeat it. But there isn't this sense of animosity or malevolence. There is a sense of respect, but there's also this sort of sense of audacity or the sense that his purpose in life is to defeat this thing. So it's hard to put it in words. It's kind of a unique characterization. There's a respect for the enemy, but it's an enemy nonetheless. And I don't want to give away any spoilers in this film, but I think the end scene of this film is probably the most important. And to understand that scene, we need to accept that throughout this film, Jacques forms this really interesting relationship with dolphins. He works with dolphins. He goes out one night and swims with all the dolphins. The Rosanna Arquette's like, what are you doing? Do you love these dolphins? And when I mentioned before with Deep Blue Sea, how Carter swam with the sharks, I think that's actually an homage to The Big Blue, how he grabs the nostril. Not the nostril. What's the front of the bottle nose? The nose. Is that what it's called, the front of a dolphin? Let's just call it the bottlenose. When he grabs that thing and he goes along with it, and he swims along with it. And it's not sexual, but it's almost sensual, the way that he deals with these dolphins. So it's almost like for Jacques, the ocean is this dominant entity that he wants to be able to dominate. In the same way that a dolphin can dominate the ocean, the dolphin can use the ocean as a highway for its life. Dolphins can't breathe underwater, but they can live underwater, and they can flip around and jump around and eat fish and live an entire life in the ocean, in the depths of the ocean. They can dive deep, they can come up for air when they need it, but they don't fear the ocean like a human being does. And I suppose that's really what Jacques is trying to overcome, the fear that the ocean has induced in seeing it cause so much tragedy. So go and watch the movie now if you don't want to have the film spoiled. But the ending of the film is really important because it's almost like this sickness that Jacques has. He has to keep going down. He has to keep diving. He can't. It's unrelenting. He, no matter what record he hits, he's always chasing this dragon. That's why it reminded me a bit of Free Solo. It's this idea of like there is no limit to the success. You know, when something is as, I'm going to use a word I always use, hegemonic as the ocean, or as dominant or as forceful as the ocean, there's kind of no limit to how far he can go to try and dominate or counter-dominate it back. And so the film ends with him going down and setting the new world record in the middle of the night when no one's even watching. You know, he's purely doing it for himself. And this dolphin sort of swims up to him and he swims away with it. Now, in the American Disney alternate ending, he resurfaces and lives, but that's not the proper French ending that Besson wants. It's pretty much implied. I mean, it's a bit ambiguous, but it's pretty much implied that his life, he's able to reach this sense of closure. Dare I say, this sense of inner peace or inner silence by essentially swimming off with the dolphins. You know, his biology and his mortality deny him an ability to be human simultaneously be a human and live amongst the ocean, to be okay with the ocean. And he has to sort of abandon his biology, abandon the human form, abandon his, abandon mortality in a way, or at least accept his end in order to live in this state of being okay with the ocean. And that's something that is sort of raised a lot throughout the film, how Enzo talks about, you know, put me back down there. That's where it's better down there. That's where the silence. They keep always talking about silence and that sort of thing. And I think that's sort of the key to all of this, is how do we reach that sense of inner silence in the abyss and that sense of inner peace in the abyss? Or is that something that we can actually reach? Can we actually achieve a sense of silence or a sense of peace without it being tragic? Because that kind of is the ultimate end of this film, which is that sense of peace and silence is only sort of achieved through tragic means. So let's move on to our last film for today's conversation. Let's put this in a realistic setting. All right, we're going to talk about The Deep Blue Sea now, Terrence Davies' film from 2011. If you haven't seen this one, it's basically a pretty simple plot. It stars Rachel Weisz. She plays a young lady named Hester. And she is married to this older man who's a high court judge, but she falls in love with a former RAF pilot played by Tom Hiddleston. So obviously there's a very obvious tension in the film, which is that she's committing adultery and betraying her pretty loyal. And I don't want to get too much into the high court judge character in this week's show, but I guess he's not a terrible guy. It's sort of just she sort of feels kind of guilty for it, but feels like she's acting truthfully. But you know, there's these other levels of tension in this film. It's a very deep exploration of the concept of depression and personal misery, and specifically suicide. And if we're talking about the idea of peace and silence, This is suicide is sort of the ultimate means of achieving a sense of silence, but it's obviously the most tragic way of doing so. So when we talk about this idea of diving down, going into the abyss to seek peace, to seek rest, to seek silence, it's kind of synonymous with suicide. And interestingly, dolphins are one of the, not to get all woo about all this, but dolphins are one of the few animals that do commit suicide. And they do so by swimming to the bottom of the ocean to do it. So when we're talking about the idea of being between the devil and the deep blue sea, which is where this film gets its name from, because obviously she's with one man and then she goes to the other and it's not good there, it's not good there, it's not good either way. This concept of the deep blue sea, it's kind of got this interesting dualistic value to it, where there is this sense of peace and silence, but it's also very tragic. It's suffocating. It's the end, right? It may seem peaceful. It may be quiet, but it is sort of the ultimate tragedy. So is there a way that we can look at this film from maybe more through a more optimistic lens, or at least from a perspective where it gives us a little bit more motivation or makes us at least a little bit more enlightened when we leave this one? Because it's a very, very depressing film, and it's kind of a hard one to finish on this week. But I want to talk about, actually, in order to do that, I want to talk about the structure of the film. This film is a lot like a film like that Anthony Hopkins film, The Father, or to a lesser extent, I think something like Inside Llewyn Davis or David Lynch's film Mulholland Drive, where the scenes can be viewed chronologically, and it's not objectively in a chronological order, but there's a way that you can follow it, so each scene is consequential of the other, or at least relates to the one that just preceded it and is about to proceed it. But the effect of the film, and I was watching with someone who actually said, is this after or before the last thing or this thing? The effect of this film, and this is sort of a signature Davies is that all of the scenes could be chronological or they couldn't be. The film works either way. You could kind of watch it forwards or backwards and it wouldn't really make a difference. And I think if we sort of put that in the context of today's conversation, the film sort of says that our experience of the abyss, that place of quiet, that place of silence, it's not really on a linear spectrum. It's not like we're ever in a place of silence and peace, or we're in a place of rage and violence, and then we can sort of go to this place of silence and peace in a terminal sense, or in a definitive sense. The only way we could actually do that is through, as we mentioned before, suicide. It's more so that being in the state of abyss, being in this suffocating kind of dark experience, is sort of this cyclical or continuous experience. So as to say, there's never going to really be a time in our life where there isn't, where we're not surrounded by some kind of sense of darkness or some kind of sense of abyss. We've talked about this a lot on the show, that the concept of the unknown is something that surrounds us, almost like the horizon. No matter how confident or not, no matter how much conviction we may have about something, there's always going to be clouds of darkness around us. And I don't mean that in the negative emotional way. I mean that more intellectually speaking, that there's always going to be things that we don't know. So there's no escaping the darkness. So it's more about how we sort of respond to it, or how we use it, or how we embrace it, rather than how we fight against it. Well, that's all we've got time for this week on Sacred Cinema, with me, your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, on 2XXFM on the 98.3 frequency. Keep listening to 2XX for more quality programming, or if you are listening online on the on-demand platform, while you're on our website, please consider sponsoring the show or subscribing to the station. That would be very much appreciated. I would also appreciate it if you could hop on Facebook and like the Sacred Cinema Facebook page. Get in contact with us. Give us feedback, be it positive or negative. Cheers.